You're listening to Face Off, episode 85, recorded September 6, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can get the show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, Mark. So beautiful. I mean, it wasn't your sort of traditional beautiful weekend in Montana this week. I saw a lot of rain. I don't know about you.
Well, I noticed it's starting to get cold, and the warm days are numbered. We're coming down to the end of summer, believe it or not.
Yeah.
It seems like it is.
There's actually snow on the mountains, yeah, which was crazy. It's like a 30% chance of snow this weekend. I like it. I can't wait. I think winter's going to be fun. I've had a busy summer, so it'll be nice to have usually things sort of slow down in the winter, I think, because of the cold. People are less apt to get crazy and do all kinds of fun activities, which are fun but keep me busy in the summer.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of sucks because I didn't get as much camping as I wanted to, even though I did a lot.
I know. That's the funny part.
Seems like in Montana, you almost have to go like every weekend
or
it doesn't feel like you've gone that much.
But then it's hard because everybody wants, everyone's having like a barbecue or something like that, and if you have a hard time saying no, you end up going to everything all the time. It's kind of hard. All right, let's get into our news and follow-ups. The first one we want to talk about is a follow-up where a web app we talked about in a previous episode, Snipped.net. It's a really cool web application. Basically, it allows you to sort of save and share scripts, snippets of code and scripts and stuff for people. It's a really cool web app. I took a look at it again when I got the sort of the news that they were going open source. And it reminded me just how really cool of a web app it is, because they have all these public snips you can browse. And so things like, I was like, man, we just, our new server is in Nginx, so I'm going to see what snips about Nginx I can get. And there's, there's sort of your sort of regular silly ones, like, here's how to restart Nginx. But then there's like an Nginx permanent 301 redirect to an external URL. Totally useful. I mean, it's a cool web app, and I think they just kind of, I'm not sure why, but I think they just, couldn't really figure out how to monetize it, and so they released it as open source, or they will be in the coming weeks.
Yeah, and they're going to put it up on GitHub, which is a code hosting service that we really like. It's really cool that companies like this do the open source thing, and I can definitely see this being used in other sites, that take this and go further, or just incorporate this into existing services.
Yeah, it's a cool little easy website written in Django. They kind of tell you at the bottom what it's written in. A lot of cool stuff. So that's really cool that they're open sourcing this. I think it's a great idea, especially it's something that we've talked about with our web app, is that if things, don't go as well as you hoped, if it's your expenses are more than your income is getting in after a while and it doesn't seem to be picking up at all, an option is to sort of, cut the cord and open source an app. And then, you're giving back to the community, the open source community as a whole. You're sort of, you're opening the source to your software as well. So people, if they're trying to decide whether or not they want to work with you, they could download and run it themselves, or even just take a look at the code. Or they just look and see that you're a company that is about helping people and not just being sort of, sort of these sniveling closed source, this is ours. It's like, hey, this didn't work out here. Everybody have with it and do with it what you want. I'm not sure what license they're open sourcing this under, but,
BSD.
BSD. Like, I would assume, we try and find a really loose license. So if someone really did try and monetize off your open source code, go ahead, because that's, cool.
Yeah. I think BSD is one of the more liberal licenses.
I believe so. When I remember looking at it, was the MIT license is sort of the most open, and I think BSD was sort of right underneath that in that. I think with like even the MIT license, I mean, you could literally take just that code and sell it. if you wanted to.
Yeah, it's basically a they're covering themselves and saying, you know, this code is just out to anybody, no general merchantability or fitness.
Yeah.
You know, they're just protecting themselves and that's it. Other than that, you can do whatever you want with it.
Yeah, exactly. So, cool. Thank you. It was Lion Burger Studios that did that. So, thanks, guys. That's cool. I appreciate it. That's cool software. The next news item we want to talk about was the sort of launch and percolation through Google's cloud of Priority Inbox.
So, I tried this out today, and so far, I seem to like it. The only thing, though, is I had set up a multiple inbox thing so I could have a another tag. For instance, I have waiting for this, and when I switched to the priority inbox, that went away.
Yeah.
So yeah, if I can figure out how to get multiple inboxes on there and still have the priority thing, it'll be useful. But right now, it kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I ran into the same thing. Yeah, I do sort of the GTD thing with my inbox where I have a waiting for and action needed. And that was sort of the same thing. Now, you still can go back to your regular inbox. It adds on the menu on the side your regular inbox and priority inbox. Your regular inbox will have your multiple inboxes, and it sort of highlights the ones that are important and stuff, which is kind of nice. But again, yeah, I think it's a really good idea because there are sort of two types of emails there, or three. You know, there's spam, which is uncalled for stuff you don't want to read. There is sort of, you know, blast out stuff, which you do want to read, but, you know, may not be that important, like newsletters or announcements from companies that you've signed up with and stuff. And then there are important stuff, like things like specific newsletters or emails from friends or human beings that you know that are just to you. And Priority Inbox tries to help you out with that because you already have, you know, spams going in the spam box. Gmail does great with that. I don't get a lot of spam anymore. But sometimes, yeah, like these special emails can kind of get lost in this sort of rigmarole of all the other emails around there. And it tries to solve them. I think it's a cool problem to solve, but I haven't found it. I mean, it wasn't something that I was kind of like, oh, my goodness, I want that right now.
Yeah, I typically get maybe 10 emails a day that actually make it to my inbox. And so to me, like going through 10 emails is not a big deal. I could definitely see this being really useful for people that get a couple hundred emails a day.
Yeah, I mean, I do. And the thing is, I keep up with it enough that it doesn't affect me as much, I guess. There's been like one or two times where someone would send me an email and I just kind of breeze through it and hit archive real quick and didn't really take the time to recognize the importance of it. Mm-hmm. I like that they're sort of trying to do that algorithmically, and that's cool. But I just didn't think it was a super killer feature. And once I got it, I played with it for, I think, 2 hours and then disabled it again and said, eh.
One thing that's nice, though, is Google is taking something and trying to make it better rather than, you know, making a whole new app or something like they did with Buzz.
Yeah, Buzz and Wave we talked about, I think, were things that I really didn't interest me with that. But, yeah, again, this is kind of what made Gmail special was it took something that was useful anyways, email, and made it even more useful and less of a pain in the butt to use.
Do you use the starred messages at all?
I do, but I use them just for ones that I need to get to without searching quickly. So let me look at my starred ones. I have typically I do like if I get an email with a tracking number in it, like a shipping tracking number. Because I'm one of those people who has to check every, you know, 2 seconds to see to see if it is. But I mean,
so then do you unstar it when you get the package?
Yep. Okay. Yeah, that's what I do. I have some that are just sort of always, you know, like when I was helping you out with a project, I have like my UPS developer tool keys starred, which I could probably get rid of now because I'm not doing that anymore. Or emails that I ended up searching for a lot that I remember having a hard time searching for because the context of the email wasn't good for searching. Like if, you know, in an email thread, someone said like, oh, yeah. Oh, and by the way, here's, you know, your IP address for your computer. And like, I can never remember my IP address, so I'd have to go look for it all the time. You know, or here I have a free shipping code for Gourmet Library from Gary Vaynerchuk that, you know, if I ever want that, I don't want to search for it again. I just want to go to the starred email. But after it expires, yeah, I will unstar it. How do you use starred emails?
I haven't actually used it. I'm always afraid that I'm going to star stuff and then they not be important or something and I just have a mess going on. So I never actually used it. I just search. Actually, what I do is I make pretty much a tag for everybody or every entity.
Interesting.
And so I actually have 121 tags.
Wow.
Or folders. I guess they're not folders really in Gmail, but they kind of are. And then like So yeah, like each one of my friends and each like comp, like Amazon's got its own folder, and I just kind of folder them.
Wow, that takes dedication though. Well, no, you use filters. Do you use filters to put most of them in? So do you have like 102 filters?
Like labels, I guess, is what the name they
use. Well, I know, but you have a label, but you can also create filters to auto label stuff. Like,
oh no, I don't do that. But like for example, like if I order something from Amazon or whatever, I click the little labels button and I type in AMA, and then Amazon's already in my list. I just hit enter. Huh. It's really not it doesn't take long to.
I guess I get too much email to do that. I guess I think I get more email than you. Like that would be horrendously annoying for me. I have a lot of labels. I mean, I don't have a lot of labels. I think I have like 15 labels. I keep like, so for a while there, I was, you know, I was the point of contact for like a position where I work. So I created a label for that so that, you know, if we ever got audited and they say, I need to see every email that's related to that position, I can do that. Then I keep labels for all my other, my outside accounts that get pulled into my primary Gmail account, like a jaderobbins.com one. And that is done through a filter. Like if it is received, it is filtered automatically with that label, which is nice.
Do you do labels for like bills, like Linode, Slicehost, or any of those?
No, because I mean those get billed anyways. So
you can just search them.
Yeah, I can just search from it. Yeah, I guess for me it's more of a. It would be harder for me. I'd have to look up the search, like the binary sort of search pattern or whatever, to figure out how to find every email that went to jrobbins@drobbins.com. So for a label and a filter for that is nice for me. But sort of like if I just search for Linode, those are probably the only emails I'm going to have from Linode.
True. So that is Gmail priority box, or priority inbox, and a little bit of how we use our Gmail. Hey. I don't know. It could be cool.
Since we did it for the show, I turned it back on, and I think I'll just continue going to my primary inbox and sort of still flagging things important or not important. And kind of letting Gmail figure it out, and then maybe I'll go back to it later because, you know, it could be useful, and maybe it will help me. I've been trying to get into the habit of not checking my email constantly because that's one of the things I do is I check it a lot, you know, if I get one or two because my Droid beeps or something. And maybe if I use Priority Inbox, it'll be easier for me to let that go and not check it quite as much and then come back, and it'll be easier for me to find the emails that I need to see quicker. So that might be something to check out. Let's get into our geek tool of the week. So this past week, I had an interesting week this past week. I forgot to buy a parking tag for my pickup. I work, I have to, you know, at Montana State University, there's, you know, you have to buy a hang tag for parking. It's like $160. It's just ridiculous. And I forgot to do it, and my old one expired. So part of that was that I decided to take the bus. So here in Bozeman, they have a bus system that's toll-free, or not toll-free, that sounds weird. There's no fare to ride the bus in Bozeman. It's totally free for now, which we'll see. But part of that was that I got my new backpack, you know, and so I'm going to ride the bus. And I also decided that, you know, that's a great way to save money because gas, you know, is expensive. Parking is expensive. The other way I decided to save money was to start taking lunch. I think we may have talked about this last week. I don't remember. But one of the things, I really love sandwiches, but I think nothing sucks more than getting your little sandwich bag in a plastic bag, shoving it in your backpack, getting to work, and it's just squished. It's just demolished. I mean, it looks nothing like a sandwich anymore. So one thing I got that is I didn't actually get the one that were one, but I got some that are similar, is the Tupperware sandwich keepers. And this is great if you ever take a sandwich. I think even if you take a sandwich, even if in a lunchbox, you just get a hard case for it because then it won't squish. You just never have to worry about that. And that, I dread that. I dread this squish sandwich, especially if you do like peanut butter and jelly. That is just, yeah, I was just murder. Like you, peanut, I think everybody's seen a light sandwich bag with like peanut butter and jelly smeared all over it from getting squished.
Yeah, and you have sticky fingers and all that good stuff that goes along with it. So these are a hard plastic kind of case that would fit like a sandwich. I saw in the comments that somebody, you know, would even put chips in there and in some a few things.
Yeah, because you can get these in a set of two for $13. They're Tupperware. Tupperware makes good stuff. I love Tupperware. It holds really well. It's sort of one of the original like plastic container companies. And so you get two of them, so you could put a sandwich in one and chips in the other, a sandwich in one, and you know, carrot and celery sticks in the other, or fruit in the other, and then you know, it's just they're good. Squish sandwiches, there's no excuse.
You know, the other thing too is if you're carrying electronics and things that are kind of expensive in your in the same bag as you know, a sandwich with a traditional sandwich bag, and if it leaks and gets sticky stuff all over your brand new MacBook Pro, that I mean that would make somebody really angry.
Oh yeah, we'll talk about
this
that.
This is something that you'd be able to just kind of slide into your laptop bag and not really worry about it, you know?
Yeah. One of the other things I like to take for lunch is leftovers, but a huge concern of mine is leftover leak in my bag. So I think one of our geek tools next week will be talking about one of the things that I'm trying to solve that problem, because I agree there's nothing you do not want that to leak anywhere. I use a sealed, you know, metal water bottle that I put like juice in or something for lunch because I do not want it to leak. You know, I use sandwich containers. I use it's an obsession. So especially like if you ride the bus, I mean, if your backpack is on your back all day, it's pretty easy to put, you know, a normal Tupperware in there and say, okay, well, this won't, my leftovers won't leak because they're, you know, going to be right side up. I'm carrying it the whole way. But if you ride the bus, like you throw it on the bag, on the floor, you throw your bag on the floor and then it's not right side up and you can get some nasty stuff. And if you buff like a nice bag full of nice electronics, it's very disheartening. So check them out. The Tupperware Sandwich Keepers. We linked to the ones in a delicious lime green color to make you happy. Let's get into our web apps for this week. Our first web app comes to us via our friend Rob Lund, and it is called HipMunk. And HipMunk is a very interesting way to search for flights.
So I tried this out. I'm flying out of Bozeman, and I'm going to Norway. And I'm leaving September. And, whoops. The great thing about this is it shows it's not cluttered. It just shows, you know, like basically a Gantt chart kind of thing of when it leaves and when you get there. By default, which I thought was funny, it's sorted by agony. So like the least the least length of flight comes up first. But you could search by price and different things. This is great. Like this is a great, it's a breath of fresh air compared to some of these sites with just stuff all over them. Very clean.
Right. Yeah. I love that it shows it sort of in this timeline with all the different flights and airports in it. Like the layovers are kind of in a different color and they tell you like where you're being layover. So, you know, I did Bozeman to Las Vegas in January, which could be, you know, we might be going to CES this year. So this is a flight that is a very real possibility. And, you know, it sort of shows it by the earliest flight gets out at about like 7 o'clock. And then the latest one that would get out is like at 11 o'clock, PM. So it kind of shows them all. So like, I can see that, you know, I could go Delta with a layover and then another Delta. I could do a Delta with a layover in Salt Lake City. It doesn't have all airlines though. Like it doesn't have, what is the one that we fly out of here in Bozeman to go to Las Vegas?
Allegiant.
It doesn't have Allegiant. So, I mean, if it was Allegiant, it would be one flight at one time. But it has all the other major ones. So, like, I could take a United from Bozeman to Denver, have a, you know, I think it looks like a half an hour layover in Denver, and then take a United flight there from Denver to Las Vegas. Really cool. Yeah, different ways to sort it. Like, if you're, you know, let me see here. Where's the, like, if I wanted the number of stops, I only want, like, one stop or two stops. Price, I can sort by price, which is, of course, important.
And you can have like tabs on that. There's like, you could do different scenarios. Like if you live like I live kind of in a place where I could easily go out of Butte or Bozeman. Butte's a half hour drive. Bozeman's an hour. So I can pick an airport that might be cheaper. So I could click new search here and have two tabs going, you know, for two different cities.
Yeah.
I mean, it's this really clean design. There's not a single advertisement on the page. It's something that you don't usually see in an airline booking type site.
Simple, cute, and clean. I mean, it's great.
The one I guess what we didn't talk is you
select your departing flight, and then after you select that, then it has you select your returning flight. So there's a whole different set of flights after you select your beginning one, and you can check it out again. So really cool. Check it out at hipmunk.com. All right. Our next web app I heard about from Steve Bristol, which we interviewed on the show. He tweeted this out. It's called AirDropper. So now you and I think a lot of other people use Dropbox because Dropbox is awesome. I mean, you can't
love it.
You can't beat it. One of the coolest parts about Dropbox is that you can right click on a file and get a public link for it. And the newest beta, you can do it in any file. In your Dropbox, you can right click and get a public link, and it'll share. It sort of makes a link that that file is public and will give you the link for it. Right as it stands right now, you have to drag the file into your public folder, and then you can right click and get the public link. But the other problem is, what if you want to get a file from someone and they don't have Dropbox? You know, I mean, it's easy for me to send a file from Dropbox, but getting it into Dropbox is kind of a pain, especially if they don't use it. You know, if they do use it, even then you're like, okay, let's share a folder. You know, sometimes like, AirDropper allows you to request a file from someone, and they go to AirDropper where they upload it via the web, and then it puts it in an AirDropper folder inside of your Dropbox.
That's awesome. So I assume that you just describe the file that you want it, and it sends them a quick little email, and it gives them a little web interface that they can actually upload the file to. And
yeah,
then
exactly.
It just
they don't have to know anything about Dropbox. That's the best part.
Great.
Yeah, exactly. You just you can't. So let's. I'm gonna send to Marco Gmail.
It looks like they use OAuth too, which is great. You don't have to give them your Dropbox password for it.
Yeah, I mean the Dropbox API is awesome. So I mean it's cool to see these apps that are integrating with it so well. So my file. And so then you can tell them like where you want them to put the folder when they upload it. And so I sent you a request for a file.
Now and my priority inbox is going to put it right at the top, of course. There it is, right at the top. Has requested a file. Click here, a secure link to upload your file. So I'm going to click here. And it's got the button's just like the biggest button on the screen. It says add files. You click it.
Yeah, it used to be you could only do one file. They just added a new feature where you can upload multiple files in one request. And then it'll plop right into my Dropbox.
This is great.
It's really sort of like the inverse of being able to publicly share a file. Now it's a way to publicly receive a file.
Huh, cool.
So check it out. Really? If you have Dropbox and you need to get a file from someone and you would just want it to be dropped directly into your Dropbox, check out AirDropper at airdropper.com. Hey, if you guys, I'm talking to you guys out there listening to the show, if you have some news, a follow-up, or web application you want us to talk about, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can email us by emailing studio@faceoffshow.com. You can tweet us out by going to @faceoffshow on Twitter. Let us know. We'd love to hear from you guys.
All right, let's get into our topic this week, which is kind of a three-stage one here. We got website monitoring, usage, and stats.
The trifecta, I like to call it. This is the website trifecta.
Usually when you hear like stats and things, you're thinking Google Analytics. We're going to talk a little bit about analytics, but we're going to kind of go a little deeper and into a little different direction here with these. But I wanted to like pose a few questions to people to kick it off here. You as a web developer working on a site, you know, should you support IE6?
No.
Should you upgrade your host?
No.
Server? You know, should you refactor code or do you need more servers?
No.
Do you need load balancing? should you add redirects for old links that are, you know, people are getting 404s and they can't get to your site and they end up, you know, leaving? When should you take your site down for maintenance if you have to? Do you do it at 1 a.m. or in the middle of the day? What features on your site are actually being used? Are people even using that great, cool feature that you just added that took 100 man hours? Are certain users seeing errors that you're not seeing on your screen or your site? Basically, the answers to these questions can't really be answered unless you are doing monitoring, checking your usage, or doing stats on your site.
Yeah.
Maybe should you support IE6? Maybe developers have such a strong opinion that it's just no, flat out.
No, I mean, it's definitely a question you have to ask. I mean, if you're targeting a web application users that are in a corporate IT environment, which probably still manage, you know, a lot of those corporate sort of infrastructures mandate IE6, and you really have no say into it.
Yeah. So, you know, if only 5% of your users are using IE6, you could probably get rid of it. But if, you know, 60 or 70% are using IE6, it's definitely something you should support.
Yeah. And you don't, like you said, you don't know these. You don't know anything about how to answer these questions until you're monitoring and looking at what your users are doing.
When I was blogging, I found that around 1% of your users will actually comment or leave feedback. So you can't really rely on your users to tell you that, you know, there's a problem with the site or they don't like the way the form, you know, they have to fill out the form and it doesn't remember what they put in before, you know, or whatever. So, you know, doing monitoring and usage, checking the usage and the stats of your site are the only thing that can actually tell you what's working and what's wrong with your site.
Yeah, one thing, it was funny, one thing that I heard when we presented AgileTask, which is the product that we just developed at our Montana Programmers Meetup. One guy was telling me, he was like, you know, I totally was going to leave feedback, but Get Satisfaction, which is what we use for our feedback, he's like, it wanted me to log in. And even though they have, like, I'm pretty sure they have OpenID, so they try to, like, ease your logging in as much as possible, he just immediately closed it and wouldn't do it. I mean, it just shows that sort of low ratio and how you have to really lower that barrier to entry for people to come and comment on your website.
Mm-hmm. And even if it's like, I mean, you don't have to log in, it's still about one, you know, because a lot of comments, you just have to put your name and your comment. It's still a very low amount of people that actually stick around to say something.
Yep.
So the first thing we're going to talk about is monitoring. Do you know if your site goes down? If it goes down in the middle of the night, you're obviously not like checking, you're not using your site at the middle of the night. Unless somebody sends you an email saying, hey, why is your site down? You wouldn't really know. So
yeah.
There's some sites out there, one pingdom.com, I think it is. Yep. Pingdom.com, which will sit there and monitor your site and tell you when it goes down. It'll actually email alert you.
Nice.
So you can get out there and start working on it. There's a script that I wrote, a simple Python script that just checks your site to see if it's up.
Another one that does it that we just talked about is BrowserMob. And with their account, you can set up, they have enough, you get enough credits per month with your free account that you can, from one site, so they have the ability to check it from different locations in the U.S. and around the world, but you have enough credits for basically one site to check every hour to see if your site is down. And so one nice part about that is it will actually monitor the load response time as well. So you can set it up to get reports, and if it does check and it's down, there is like an alert that you can have it send out to people.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that is usually the sites like that keep a history too. So if your site goes down at certain times of the day or whatever, you can kind of pinpoint problems. Another thing to check is CPU usage. A lot of like virtual private hosts, you know, VPSs, offer, you know, some kind of a dashboard where you can see your CPU over time, and also set up like alerts if the CPU goes over 80% for a period of time, you know, email you so you can get over there and maybe bump it up or figure out if there's a problem, you know, that's something that's eating up the CPU.
God, whenever people are uploading a lot of pictures, my CPU goes way up. Maybe I should look at my file uploader.
Memory usage is another one, similar to CPU, that you got to watch out.
Yeah, the memory is a really big one, because I find that the symptoms of low memory are very erratic. Whenever we've been messing around with a web app and it gets low on memory, it's almost like the last thing you think of, like, oh, I don't know, maybe it's memory. And then like, oh, because all the symptoms of the goofiness that happens usually do not sort of immediately line up and say low memory.
Another really big one, especially if you have an e-commerce site, is to check the shopping cart is working. You know, yep. A lot of like, one of the ways you can do this is write a Selenium script, which is a web integration testing framework. And so you could have it actually like add something to your cart, and then, you know, whatever cart you're using, if you're using a custom one, using authorized.net or whatever, see if you can at least get to the checkout screen.
Again,
you know, sometimes if you have a problem and that's down, you're losing money, you know.
Yeah, again, really one of the really cool parts about BrowserMob, it's kind of funny, I don't mean to bring them up as much, is that they were the one that we talked about that support Selenium scripts. So your uptime script could be, rather than just seeing if the site's up, it could be seeing if the site's up and running through your Selenium script, which might run through your shopping cart or something. And if that doesn't work, then your site is down, you know, according to them, and they'll notify you.
That's a great point. Like Site Monitor, the script that I created, it just checks to see if the site gives a 200.
Right.
But what if the file got overwritten and it's just a blank HTML page? The site would still be up.
Like 200.
You know, it's from the point of view of the script, but if there's nothing there, you know, the point of the view of the user is it's still down.
Yep.
So that's a good point on the Selenium. Performance monitoring. Google Webmaster Tools has a crawl statistics, and it shows the response, as well as BrowserMob, as you mentioned. This is great, especially tracking over a period of time. You know, if you start adding a lot of code and you're your response time gets slower and slower over time. You can kind of see that.
Totally.
Because they do a graph of a period of time. Checking SQL queries and database load. There's log files and things you can do to monitor that. SQL queries you could probably do your own checking with, but like database load, it's probably going to be more of a VPS type scenario there. Like if you're on shared hosting, you probably don't have too much control over how much load that database is going to have. Errors and bugs for monitoring these. It's sometimes good to have, if there's a, depending on the level of error it is, you can have that error get alerted to you. Like if the app can't connect to the database or something, you kind of want to have that alerted out right away so you can get an email and go over and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that you might not want an email, but you want to kind of keep an eye on is 404s. 404s are the HTTP status code for a page that's missing.
Yep.
And it's good to like keep this in a database to where if you're getting a lot of a same URL that's 404'd, its chances are that it's linked from somewhere that hasn't updated their links.
Yeah, exactly.
And you could write a simple redirect that just goes to the updated page or even goes to the homepage if it's something that's totally irrelevant. And at least it keeps the user flowing to your site or the updated article rather than to a blank page where they just have to hit the back button.
Or even worse, if someone else links to a page on your website that doesn't exist, that sucks. Usually it's not terrible, but something that looks really unprofessional is if you are linking to your own stuff that doesn't exist.
Right.
If you're at AgileTask website and you click on a link at AgileTask to AgileTask and at 404s, that looks bad.
Yeah. So 404s really tell a story, and it's often very useful to keep track of those and where they're coming from. Google Webmaster Tools, again, if their crawler catches a 404, it will put it in its log.
Yep,
so it's also helpful to check that.
Especially critical if you have a blog, because blogs sort of thrive on linking to and fro, and you really need those links to work.
As far as usage, things that need to be answered, and it depends on your server setup, but you need to kind of know your peak times.
Totally.
It helps determine when you're going to do scheduled maintenance.
Very
and
important.
When
yeah.
you lots of things actually get answered by that question. How many concurrent users can your site take? You can do load testing that we kind of talked about.
Yep. Totally.
What are your most used features and pages? Can you cut out features that aren't really being used? Can you improve the ones that are actually being used?
Yeah, we talk about that all the time, refactoring and only needing to do what you need to. And if you have a feature that really is not getting used and you're maintaining that code or it has any sort of load on your service at all, you really should be monitoring to be able to cut that out.
Yeah, one of the ones, an example on AgileTask is when you add a task, there's a button there that says add. It might be that 90% of our users don't even use the button, and maybe we could get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe 50% use it, and then we couldn't get rid of it. Kind of questions we'd have to know.
Our API, it was a feature that we thought people would use, but let's say after 2 years, we only have 3 users that are making any sort of normal, useful calls to the API. It's like, why are we maintaining that code?
Exactly.
Let's just get rid of it.
Another one is, your search relevant? I wish more sites would check the logs with searching. If you find that most users are clicking in your search box, typing in a query, and then hit the back button and don't actually click on any of the links that are on the page, chances are your search is totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
You should just take it off your page. But maybe it's a great search. I don't know. You have to check. stats, Google Analytics is great. Boomerang, we talked about, which is a Yahoo JavaScript client-side one, which will give you performance numbers. Errors, you need to check your log files and make sure, look for errors. If people are trying to submit a form and it errors out or something, you wouldn't know that unless you looked at your logs.
Totally.
And so fix that kind of stuff. One of the things that really helped me was Clicktail, which is a service we talked about a while ago, which actually does basically like a video capture of what the user does on your site. And it really helps to catch usability issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
If users are getting confused on how to navigate the page or whatever, it'll be clearly visible there.
Yeah, it almost pops out at you and you're like, ugh.
Yeah. If you have a web app where you have a paid subscription versus free users, you know, how many, what percentage of which, you know, good information to know.
Totally.
Other things you can do, and we've talked about this before, is A/B split testing. You know, is this placement of this ad a good place, or is this a good place for this feature in our app, or should it be moved over here?
Totally.
Google Website Optimizer is a good tool to help do that. And what keywords are people searching within your site? If you do have a search on your site, what keywords are people using? That often will give you an indicator of navigation items you should add, maybe, if they can't find something consistently. Yeah, exactly. They're finding, you know, they're not finding something. You maybe need to make that part of your navigation.
Yeah. Yeah, clearly that's a big issue. So actually, I'll make this commitment now. What we're going to do is you talked about up in monitoring that monitoring errors and bugs. So next week, our two web apps are going to be related to that. I have a couple really cool ones I want to talk about, and we'll talk about then. I wish I would have thought about that before we did this episode, because we would have done those now. But we'll do that next week. That wraps up this episode of Face Off. I hope that helps you guys figure out, you know, how important website monitoring usage and stats are, and some tips on how to do it. I want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. If you want to subscribe via email, RSS, all kinds of cool ways, you can do that there. You can also leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Tweet us out, send an email. We'd love to hear from you guys, and we've gotten some great feedback from our listeners lately, so we really appreciate that. You guys are awesome. Thank you for listening. We really appreciate it, and we will see you guys next week.